This evening, I thought it would be worth taking a step back and reflecting on some of the lessons of the crisis and the post-crisis period. Certainly, there are a lot of things I've learned in my time so far as head of financial stability at the Reserve Bank. For those of you who don't know, I started in this role on October 20, 2008, just a few weeks after Lehman Brothers failed and a string of other institutions failed. And yet there were a few moments where I did wonder what I was thinking applying for the role. As you can imagine, the first few months were frantic. The Australian financial system and the economy here actually weren't doing too badly. But there was always a possibility that investor panic could result in a run on Australian institutions. And after some governments overseas guaranteed the banks in their countries, Australia had little choice but to follow suit. The financial stability team at the bank were heavily involved, both in designing the guarantee and in putting it in place. And in fact, I personally processed several applications. It was just all hands on deck. The subsequent years have been just as busy. First came the wave of regulatory reform globally, directed by the G20. Australia's role in the international standard setting process also expanded. Before 2009, the Australian authorities were not even members of the Basel Committee on Bank Supervision, which is the primary standard setter for bank regulation. But now, both APRA and the Reserve Bank have seats at the table. And the bank, as a result, has had to get more involved with the details of prudential standard setting than it used to do in the years before the crisis. Once the international standards were agreed, next came the wave of implementation. There's still some work to do in some areas in the reform process, but many of the big pieces of the reform agenda are in place in most countries, or they soon will be. Now the third wave of post-crisis work is to assess that implementation. Almost all the main reform initiatives from groups such as the G20 are soon followed up by a cross-country peer review to check how countries have implemented the reforms and whether they've implemented them on the agreed timetable. So we're all checking up on each other. And this comes on top of the usual rounds of international scrutiny that the authorities go through, such as the IMF Financial Sector Assessment Program, which Australia went through in 2012. I think policymakers have learned a lot over the last 6 years, and I'd like to spend some time reflecting on some of the lessons that I think are most important. The first lesson is that asking the right question is half the battle. We need to ask, what problem are we actually trying to solve? Central banks and supervisors are mandated to promote financial stability, or some variant on those words. But remarkably, there's not been much consensus in how to actually define that, how to actually make that concrete. For some, it's about preserving market functioning. For others, it's about avoiding undesirable movements in asset prices or exchange rates. In Australia, at least, we focus on the risk of a disruption in the financial system that is so severe it causes harm to the real economy. We don't try and pre-specify the form that disruption might take. We focus on the ultimate goal. There's a recent research paper using household survey data from Europe that shows that people don't actually care about financial imbalances for their own sake. In fact, anyone who's been to an auction would realise that a lot of people probably enjoy it. People don't care about financial imbalances, they care about incomes and employment, about output. And at a deep level, a financial stability mandate is really an output mandate. We want to avoid financial instability because it reduces output and harms human welfare through that channel. History shows that downturns are worse and recoveries are slower when there's been a banking or broader financial crisis. Our policies, after all, should serve the interests of society and improve the welfare of society. And in fact, the welfare of society is one of the bank's legislated mandates. Research, like the paper I just mentioned, tells us something important about how we pursue those ends. As policymakers, we do not, should not, care about asset prices or credit for their own sakes. Nor do we care if banks are safe just for the sake of having safe banks. Rather, we care whether a bank that did fail might do so in a way that harms the real economy. Banks are firms, and firms do not love or hurt or vote, but people do. And people are harmed by the recessions, by the loss of their life savings, their homes, of all the things that financial instability can inflict upon the world. And so that's why we pursue the stability of the financial system and the firms within it, but we're not trying to pursue a no failures, nothing ever goes wrong, no firm ever fails kind of regime. We're not trying to eliminate all risk. Some risk is necessary to actually innovate. We're not mandated to serve the interests of some firms ahead of the interests of society. Society's welfare might not be best served by policies that seek to minimise variability in property markets or asset prices more broadly, or some measure of credit. I mean, it might be how it works out in practice, perhaps. But our objectives and our policy practice must be founded on the welfare of society as best we understand it. And that comes back to output. It comes back to the fact that financial instability is harmful to output and employment. Property markets, asset prices, credit, and the array of other variables we look at, they're not objectives, they're information variables. They're useful, but we shouldn't define our performance in terms of having control over those variables exclusively. What matters more is the risk of a crisis and the severity of the resulting effects on output. Because behind those output figures, there's a real human cost to financial instability. And the recent crisis, the global financial crisis, was a standout example of this. Unemployment rates increased dramatically in a range of countries. People lost their livelihoods, their savings, their homes. This graph shows the share of US mortgages that were behind on their repayments. That's the blue line. As well as the separate group is the pink line that was subject to foreclosure proceedings in each period. The sum of those two lines peaked at 9%. Even when you factor in the people who owned their homes outright without a mortgage, that means a significant fraction of the population was in distress. The total number of American families that actually lost their homes over this whole period ran into the millions. Financial instability is also contagious. Many of the people who lost their jobs or their homes in the years following the crisis hadn't contributed to the build-up of risk. They were simply hit by the ensuing recession. The economic effects of the crisis can also spread to countries that had not been part of the financial crisis itself, such as many in the Asian region. And you can see that in this graph. It shows a very sharp fall in industrial production, both in Japan and in the rest of Asia, excluding China. Very sharp fall following the crisis, took a very long time to recover. And I find it remarkable that those declines are larger and longer lasting than the later downward spikes you can see in both series, which are the earthquake and tsunami in Japan and the flooding in Thailand. Extraordinary that someone else's financial crisis can do that to another country. So the problem we're trying to solve is to reduce the risk and cost of financial instability, and we should therefore seek to reduce the build-up of risk, which might or might not manifest as a boom in asset prices and credit. We should also seek to make the system resilient to the shocks that occur from time to time, so that the system doesn't end up in crisis following every unexpected event. In framing the objectives of financial stability policy in this way, it becomes clear that rapid developments in property markets, other asset prices and credit can be, but are not always, a signal that financial stability risks are building. I do not underestimate the challenge of disentangling that signal from the normal transmission mechanism of monetary policy. Asking the right question about our goal turns out to have been less obvious than you might imagine. A lot of the pre-crisis debate around financial stability policy was framed around the question, should monetary policy prick bubbles? Now, the first problem with this question is it assumed what the policy instrument should be. Monetary policy might be part of the solution, but you shouldn't assume it is. It might not be. The second problem with the question was it assumed that asset price bubbles were the crux of the policy problem. The debate could then be diverted into entertaining discussions about whether you could identify bubbles, how you could do that, whether you could pop them before they become dangerously large, again, assuming that you could do that without too many bad side effects. I have two reservations about framing the policy problem in this way. The first is that the policy debate then ends up being about my model versus yours, which is fun for economists, but maybe not so helpful for everyone else. The estimate of the bubble component of prices is only as good as the model of fundamentals. And getting bogged down in arguments about models is just a recipe for inaction. Another problem with framing, with this kind of framing of the policy problem is that actually, a bubble in asset prices is not even necessary for a financial stability problem to occur later on. It's particularly so in property markets where supply is inherently more or less fixed because most of it's already been built. In that case, you can get large price and construction cycles that actually appear at the time to be completely consistent with fundamentals. And I can perhaps illustrate that best with a data series that's got nothing to do with property. This series is called the Baltic Dry Index. It summarises the price of bulk shipping services as opposed to container shipping. As you can see, there are a number of drawn-out price cycles, big booms over several years that subsequently crash. The pattern's most noticeable around the last decade or so, but if you take the lower base into account, the price cycle around 1994 was also very large. Now, I don't know about you, but I struggle to imagine how one could have a bubble in shipping services. They're a service. They're not an asset that you can store and on-sell. What we see here isn't a bubble, but it's exactly the kind of boom-bust price dynamics that can occur when underlying supply is more or less fixed. As with property, it takes time to build ships, and the annual production of ships is only a small fraction of those currently operating. So an increase in demand for their services, because of a boom in world trade, say, eventually hits the vertical part of the short-run supply curve, where there simply are no more spare ships. Shipbuilders respond, but it takes a while for the new ships to be completed. Prices fall, and if those new ships come online at the same time that world trade is weakening, as it did, as you can see quite clearly in late 2008, early 2009, then the size of that price fall can be dramatic. Turns out property markets show the same dynamic. And we can see that from this graph, which shows that its commercial real estate prices, office property in Australia. Large price cycles can happen even while prices stay broadly in line with rents. And of course, property, broadly defined, is much more important to the Australian financial system than the shipping industry is. But you certainly see the same issues in shipping lent loans to shipping companies in the countries that do have big involvement in shipping. So now consider that many markets of this kind, including property as well as shipping, involve a lot of leverage. When prices fall, the entities in these markets can become stressed. Their spending falls. Well, that would affect the real economy directly. And if they have a lot of debt and they default on it, there can be further repercussions through the financial system. You don't actually need a speculative bubble. So asset price bubbles are certainly one development that we do have to watch for. But if we're asking the right policy question, we have to look for much more than that. In framing the objective of financial stability policy as something other than the absolute level of some asset price, I'm not saying that asset prices don't matter to social welfare. For example, whenever housing prices boom, people worry that housing has become unaffordable. Now, of course, if prices are rising, it must be that someone could afford those prices. If they're motivated by speculative expectations, though, prices can run ahead of levels that can be sustained in the longer term. So there can be a financial stability angle to those concerns. If a future fallout is likely to harm the real economy, either directly or via distress in the financial system. But the real policy concern here is that some people get priced out. It's fundamentally a question of distribution, particularly intergenerational distribution. This is not in the remit of financial stability policy, and the two should not be conflated. But we should be mindful of this equally legitimate goal of public policy, which is to ensure that everybody can access appropriate housing, appropriate shelter, that they can reasonably afford. Sometimes this goal mutually supports the goal of financial stability. But as we saw in the US housing meltdown, if you get the policy response to an affordability issue wrong, then the consequences for financial stability can be dire. The second important lesson that I've drawn from the last few years is that financial stability analysis and policy are multifaceted. It requires more than one approach to analysis and more than one policy instrument to respond. And as such, it will often require more than one agency or arm of government to work together. I came to this role from the monetary policy side of the bank. Having seen both sides, it's clear to me that financial stability policy is a bit different. Perhaps unfairly, monetary policy reminds me of this picture. I mean, he's even wearing a tie. The sea might be stormy. The view ahead might be obscured by fog. The timing of the waves might be completely unpredictable. Even with a lot of information, you might only have a vague idea of exactly where you are now. But at least you know roughly where you're going. You have a single target. And you have a single instrument that you know usually works and that can steer you in approximately the right direction. Financial stability policy looks rather different, more like this. When thinking about the risks in the financial system, there seem to be a lot of moving parts. It isn't obvious how they all connect. There's some legacy bits and pieces like that gramophone horn that you're not really sure what it's still doing there. And there seem to be many places where you can intervene and have some effect, although perhaps not the one that you were expecting. That complexity has implications for the approach to analysis. Rather than try to estimate a single model of fundamentals and look for bubbles, you've got to look at all the evidence and try to piece together the story. I sometimes think it's a bit like the work of an archaeologist. You're never going to have complete information. Some of it's disappeared. But somewhere in the shards of pottery and all the other little bits and pieces, you can make it out a coherent explanation that fits with all the pieces you have. And that's really the best you can do. That complexity also has implications for the appropriate policy framework. Because the risks can come from so many different sources, it doesn't make sense to restrict oneself to a single policy tool in response, or even a small collection of tools. In fact, it's probably a mistake to focus solely on policy tools for responding to current risks. In other words, policies of waiting until you have a problem before you do anything. I think it's worth devoting a bit more time to thinking about the design of the overall policy framework and how that might support financial stability. For a start, it's very hard to have a good financial stability outcome without the right macroeconomic policy framework. Now, if we abstract from the recent US crisis for a moment and think about the broader run of crises in the modern era, we can see how important it is to get the broader macro and fiscal frameworks right. In emerging and middle-income countries, foreign currency borrowing and other cross-border issues are much more of a concern than whatever's going on in mortgage markets, which are often quite small in these countries. Australia is known as a country that's been able to use a fully floating exchange rate to absorb shocks from abroad. More fundamentally, a fully floating exchange rate regime means that monetary policy can be set according to domestic conditions, and balance of payment surpluses do not expand money and credit. With a floating exchange rate and a sufficiently forward-looking approach to inflation targeting, it's less likely that monetary policy settings will unleash a period of overly exuberant asset price and credit growth. Financial markets and asset prices respond more quickly to monetary policy than output and inflation do. So we shouldn't be surprised that if interest rates are somehow too low for domestic circumstances, the financial stability effects of that arise before the inflation effects. So it's important to get the monetary framework right. It takes some work to get the institutions right to make it possible to float with confidence. In particular, you need deep liquid hedging markets. This ensures that domestic entities are ultimately borrowing in the domestic currency if they don't have foreign currency revenue, even if the original bond that they issued was, for example, in foreign currency. What that means is that they're both protected from the worst effects of exchange rate volatility and given the incentive to manage their FX risk. And they're not lulled into a false sense of security that the exchange rate will remain stable because that's what the authorities are trying to do. As part of the overall macro policy framework, it might also help to design the tax system in a way that avoids overly rewarding leveraged speculation, particularly in property. There are often reasonable sounding rationales for things like generous deductibility of interest payments. The result is sometimes, in some countries, to make leveraged speculation in second-hand assets tax-preferred to investments in new income-producing assets that don't generate capital gains. These rationales need to be balanced against the costs of financial instability, as well as the more conventional concerns about resource allocation favouring speculative assets. Calibrating the regulatory framework appropriately also helps promote financial stability. This includes the regulatory framework for consumer protection when extending credit. This area of regulation is often underappreciated, but it's an important line of defence against an extreme easing in lending standards, especially if some lenders are not prudentially supervised. Meanwhile, in Australia, household borrowers have recourse to arbitrators and the courts if they believe they've fallen victim to predatory lending. And there certainly are cases in Australia where the courts have struck down or reduced loans that the lender should not have made. That is a powerful incentive not to engage in various kinds of abuses, such as lending based on fictional incomes. Remember the ninja loans from the subprime crisis. The prudential regulatory framework also needs to be calibrated appropriately. If a potentially harmful credit boom does occur, should you necessarily conclude that you need to engage in some kind of counter-cyclical, periodic tightening in prudential policy? Well, maybe, but maybe not. If the overall framework is simply calibrated too loosely, too laxly, you get the same outcome. It's observationally equivalent. Perhaps the whole regime just needed to be tighter. And that's what the Basel III package of reforms from the Basel Committee actually achieved in banking regulation. Of course, this means that the objective of the prudential regime needs to include, or be compatible with, at least, promoting financial stability. If you specify the mandates of the policymakers appropriately, this needn't be a problem. I'll talk about this a bit more in a moment, but there's no need to constrain the mandate of prudential supervision to be the safety of individual institutions. To do so is a choice, and it's one that hasn't worked out so well in some other countries. Even if the overall policy framework's well designed, there could still be a build-up of risks to financial stability that one might need to respond to. And again, the system is so complex and the potential sources of risk so diverse, it doesn't make sense to restrict the policy response to one or a few different policy tools. The response also has to be multifaceted. You know, the early 2000s debate, the pre-crisis debate about policy responses to asset price developments was mainly about how monetary policy should respond. That's still an open question. One can imagine situations where one might want policy to be a bit tighter and inflation lower than target for financial stability considerations. After all, monetary policy is about setting the price of credit. But as I mentioned a few moments ago, setting monetary policy according to domestic circumstances is surely the first step. Prudential regulation and supervision can help lean against credit excesses and is perhaps more direct than monetary policy. But it gets less attention in global policy debates, perhaps because supervision is in some sense invisible. You can't graph engagement with boards. You can't even see the supervisor's implied threat of using directions powers or Pillar 2 capital add-ons, higher capital requirements. But those powers, if credible, can shape bank behaviour and risk-taking. And of course, in Australia, the central bank is not the supervisor. So it raises the question of what the central bank can do to promote financial stability if it's not the supervisor. Well, for a start, central banks have a long-standing role as liquidity providers, the lender of last resort, as it's sometimes known. These functions are essential to the authority's crisis management, planning and response. And they also allow the bank to gather market intelligence relevant to financial stability. But beyond those traditional functions of central banking, the financial stability function has, I've always thought, two tools: the telephone and the microphone. The telephone is, of course, for calling APRA and sharing our concerns. Central banks have a concentration of analytical resources, highly skilled people accustomed to analysing economic and financial data. APRA does too, but having people with different training and perspectives and expertise looking at these issues from different angles really helps ensure that emerging risks are not missed. And if a particular risk involves parts of the financial system that are not prudentially supervised, the central bank or the securities regulator is likely to be better placed to join the dots. The other policy tool, the microphone, is a reference to communication. I gave a speech a couple of years ago where I used cartoons to make my point because there were no graphs that I could use. So here I am again with another cartoon. This time I had to use a sophisticated computer algorithm to get that casual hand-drawn look. But the essential point, all jokes aside, is that people's expectations matter. Exposing and warning of risks can ideally change at least some people's behaviour and steer the system away from higher risk outcomes. At this point, I should probably mention macroprudential policy. By now, it should be clear that the Australian authorities' views on this supposedly new toolkit are a little bit different from those in some other jurisdictions. We view macroprudential policy as something to be subsumed into the broader financial stability framework, not separate. We recognise that quantitative restrictions were already tried in the 60s and 70s, and they didn't always work that well. And we think that it's entirely acceptable for prudential measures, macro or otherwise, to be wielded by the prudential supervisor, assuming they have the appropriately formulated mandate. And of course, a successful financial stability policy framework needs to operate across more than one kind of policy response. And that means it must cross several public agencies. That's another way in which the financial stability policy is a multifaceted effort. These agencies need not only to coordinate, but to achieve a deeper level of engagement. If the Australian experience is a guide, achieving close and effective engagement comes down to consistent mandates and genuine respect among equals. The rationale for carving out particular bits of the prudential framework under separate governance, which seems to be what people mean nowadays by macroprudential tools, appears to be that supervisors cannot be relied upon to discharge their duties with system-level concerns in mind. Now, that might be true in some countries, but it's not true in Australia, and it's not true in quite a few other countries in the region. And it does not strike me as being particularly respectful of the expertise of supervisors. The last thing we would want is the situation shown in this cartoon, where the central banker on the left is assuming that he or she knows better than the prudential supervisor on the right. So the division between micro-prudential supervision, narrowly focused on individual institutions, and system-wide macro-prudential supervision never made much sense to us in Australia. You can't promote the safety of institutions without considering their environment, which includes the financial system as a whole. If the supervisory agency really is micro-prudential in outlook, fixing its mandate might be needed. Fixing its mindset is surely equally important. And as I've explained in a previous occasion at a different speech, here in Australia, the authorities consider macroprudential policy to be better described as a state of mind rather than a suite of tools. Another way of describing this is as macroprudence rather than macroprudential. That state of mind informs the design of the overall prudential framework. It does not need to be restricted to periodic responses when emerging risks are detected. A good example of what this means for prudential regulation and supervision is the Prudential Practice Guide on Mortgage Lending, which APRA released in draft form recently. Instead of setting out prescriptive rules, APRA's approach has been to empower bank boards to demand prudent lending policies and practices from their banks. The bank had flagged the release of this document in the last financial stability review, which we published in March. And while it's APRA's policy and APRA's document, naturally the bank and APRA shared views about it during the drafting process. And we fully support what APRA is doing in this area. It's calibrating the overall framework with a view to market-wide concerns, rather than responding from time to time with specific interventions. Now, that's not to say that some counter-cyclical tightening of prudential policy is never warranted. But if monetary policy responds appropriately to domestic circumstances, and if the prudential framework is sufficiently tight, and if there are no leakages through public sector involvement in absorbing credit risk, and yes, I recognise that's a lot of ifs, the set of circumstances in which you need that counter-cyclical prudential response is going to be much narrower. The third lesson I've taken from the past few years is that there is still a great deal to learn. On the policy side, there's been a lot of experimentation with new and changed policies. Some of these changes to the prudential framework, such as the higher capital requirements and new liquidity rules in the Basel III package, they're pretty predictable. The main effects are things that we have a pretty good idea about. They will make the banking system safer and more resilient. In the case of the liquidity rules, most jurisdictions already had some kind of requirement. Now, like capital, these are going to be harmonised globally. Some of the other policies might be seen as being a little bit more adventurous. For example, the move to central clearing and derivatives markets will change how those markets operate. And at the very least, the existing statistical relationships between various pieces of data can be expected to change. That's a perennial issue for analysis when there's a regime change in regulation or policy more generally. The scope for learning is perhaps even greater on the analytical side. I think this is an exciting time for researchers and policy analysts alike. It's far too early to present a unified framework for financial stability analysis. It might not even be possible. It may be a retirement project for me. It's a while away. Even so, we can piece together some of the important factors that we need to look at in our work. Essentially, we're looking at the behaviour of participants in the economy and financial system, especially the risk they're taking, as well as any rent-seeking behaviour. Their behaviour is shaped by behavioural traits, as well as the incentives they face, which in turn are determined by the institutional environment, tax, legal systems, regulation and developments in the rest of the world, just to take a few examples. And the combination of how people and firms behave and the shocks that they face will determine their resilience, how vulnerable they are to become distressed, and what that might mean for financial stability and thus the health of the real economy. Now, each of these pieces is going to require some theory to make sense of it, much of which is yet to be developed. They'll also require some data to track what's happening, much of which does not yet exist. Thus, even as the program of post-crisis regulatory reform reaches its latter stages, our task will remain challenging and will continue to evolve. In sum, there's still a lot, huge amount, to learn in this complex and multifaceted world of financial stability analysis and policy. And if asking the right question is half the battle, answering it is surely the other half. Accordingly, I stand ready to at least try to answer your questions tonight. And thank you very much for listening.
I'm George Shearer, I'm a state public servant. You talk about stability. Now, are you talking about long-term or short-term stability? And the United States seems to have been pursuing stability with quantitative easing. And it might have achieved stability, but some writers argue that it is only to counteract deflation, and it might be postponing some sort of crunch that will come in the long term. So is quantitative easing working? Is it in the service of stability? And is it deferring a crisis, or is it a useful thing in its own right?
Thanks. It's a very interesting question, and I think it gets to the heart of the nexus between monetary policy and financial stability policy and why those functions need to work together, including across agencies. Quantitative easing is what you have left once you hit the zero lower bound on interest rates in sort of modern monetary policy. It's a harder thing to manage. It's less well understood because it hasn't been tried as often. But deflation in a world where there is debt is surely a much worse outcome than sort of macroeconomic stimulation on the other side. There is an asymmetry to the policy mistakes you can make. So without wanting to comment in too much detail on other countries' monetary policy, I think this is a policy tool that seems to work at some level. And I think certainly financial stability policy is something where you've got to think about all of the phases, all of the time horizons, both shorter term and longer term, and that's absolutely one of the things that we think about. I think there has been a little bit of an assumption that, you'll get yours in the end. There's always this idea that, how dare you sail through the crisis, we didn't sail through the crisis, but, how dare you not have the crisis, surely you'll get your comeuppance. And there's an assumption that there are comeuppances lying in wait for people, and I don't think we should assume that. But certainly thinking about the long term as well as the short term is absolutely part of what we do in financial stability circles.
Hi, Dr. Ellis. Can I just follow on with a supplementary to that question?
Sure.
With the amount of quantitative easing has taken place, which has doubled or trebled the world money supply in much of the developed world in the last few years, on a pretty much stagnant real asset base, would we not think that that would contribute to financial instability if that real asset base starts growing again around the world? The classic case of driving down the value of money on a growing real asset base would unleash an inflation monster. We'll just get some commentary on that.
Well, I think there has been actually some very useful research about monetary policy on the zero lower bound, and we haven't seen that in Japan. Japan has actually been trying this for 20 years, and we haven't yet seen the inflation monster. I think there is actually some very useful academic research that models that, and it doesn't find that the inflation monster... And guess what? If we suddenly find you have inflation and the real economy is growing, well, we know what to do.
Greg O'Connell, I'm an engineer. I'm not an economist. I'm a private investor.
Good for you.
Thank you.
Not everyone should be an economist.
I'd like to pursue the quantitative easing question a little bit further. You talked about risks and policy addressing and mitigating risks. Would you be prepared to speculate on what risks you see for the Australian economy when quantitative easing does start to wind up and come to an end, and what that might mean for those of us in Australia?
You've asked a very interesting and very big question, and I will do my best to answer it. Essentially, what you're saying is, what happens when the US economy starts looking better? That's probably not a bad thing.
Well, there's an assumption that it gets better, but yes, when it gets...
But, I mean, that's the thing, is you've got to say, under what circumstances would the US start... I mean, they've already started tapering their asset purchases. I think the more important question is what happens when interest rates rise. This is something that has been imagined. This is something where people have thought through some of the implications. There's a lot of work being done internationally thinking about, well, what is the interest rate risk in the banking system? If you think about, I talked in the speech about the sort of broader run of crises, particularly in emerging markets, where people have foreign currency borrowing and then suddenly, exchange rates move, they weren't prepared for it. I think Australia is in a very useful position that most of the time the exchange rate is a shock absorber rather than a shock creator. So I think another way to frame your question is, what happens when the US economy has recovered enough that the Fed starts raising interest rates? Well, some people probably will get caught out by that in global financial markets, but I can't help seeing that as good news.
Jeff Harcourt, I used to be here.
Professor Harcourt.
I've always thought that quantitative easing was aiming at the wrong assets or the wrong nature of spending. I would have thought it would have been much better when repercussions on the real economy occurred if central banks had allowed governments to write checks on them to finance green friendly infrastructure, to help the construction industry, to tackle global warming, and to reduce the high levels of unemployment that have resulted from the crisis. Whereas they've concentrated on buying financial assets, in the hope that people, the built-up liquidity, someone would want to borrow. But as we know, if expectations and animal spirits are dim, no one wants to borrow. So it seems to me you've built in huge amounts of holdings of financial assets, whereas you could have done real and useful things, as you stress that the integration of finance and the real economy is what our objective ought to be.
Professor Harcourt, you've asked a very pertinent question. If it were possible for governments to purchase goods and services instead of assets, or for the public sector broadly to purchase goods and services instead of assets, wouldn't that be more direct? I think it probably would have been. But I think one of the things we have seen over the last few years is concerns about the appropriateness of fiscal positions, rightly or wrongly. And, of course, in Europe at least, there is actually a treaty that says the ECB can't do that. So that's not about the ECB allowing something or not allowing something, or indeed, you know, reserve banks around the world allowing or not allowing something. If the legislation says they can't, they can't stop. You know, it's up to the political, you know, infrastructure to actually say, well, let's do it that way. And it's not clear to me that that would have been politically possible in some countries, and that's probably about as far as I want to go on that.
Thank you. My name is Jim Orkin. I'm a businessman, and I'm just wondering whether long periods of stability, which is what you're aiming for, eventually lead to overconfidence, which leads to the crisis.
That is a really pertinent question.
Just before this event,
I gave a talk to some of the students here at University of Adelaide, and I pointed out to them that, you know, when I started my working life, I graduated into the 1991 recession in Melbourne, which, as an Adelaide businessman, you would know how bad that was also in Adelaide. And, of course, a lot of the people who are graduating now weren't born during that. And so, I mean, there's a real direct question about, you know, can you end up with a situation of complacency? Can you end up with people becoming complacent about risk, pricing risk too low? I think that does describe what was going on in 05 and 06. The price of risk in global financial markets had gotten very low. And I think the main bulwark against that is people like me who are paid to worry and will do it reflexively anyway. And so I think having the right mandate is really important there. But I agree, it is, you know, can people be lulled into a sense of complacency by things being good all the time, and as, you know, something could go wrong at some point. But as I mentioned earlier with another question, we also shouldn't assume that that means that there's some kind of moral comeuppance lurking, lying in wait for us. I think it is a matter of remaining alert but not alarmed.
Dr. Ellis, my name is Mark Coleman. I'm a chartered accountant, so I'd like to thank you for your presentation, and I'd like to thank, as an economics alumnus, I'd like to thank Professor Harcourt for teaching me economics. But my question, in my work, I see that, excuse me, a lot of dislocation in China. I need some of your water, I think. But I see a lot of dislocation because of shadow banking, and you haven't mentioned the less regulated field.
Well, I didn't mention it directly in this talk. There are, in the G20 reform agenda post-crisis, there have been four legs. One was making banking safer. That's primarily the Basel III package, although not only that. There's making derivatives markets safer. That would be a whole lecture in itself. There is resolution, so dealing with banks that are failing and other institutions that are failing, so that when they do fail, they don't fail so ugly the way Lehman did. But shadow banking is the fourth. Well, I mean, it's not, you know, we actually missed it in a different order, but shadow banking is one of those four. And we're very aware globally that if you tighten regulation on one sector of the financial system, activity will move into the less regulated areas. And that's an important issue. The Chinese authorities are very aware of this. It is very hard in an economy that is so big and so complex and has so many pieces. And they're still, I mean, it's evolving very quickly, their financial system, so it's hard to get a handle on. I think in Australia we're quite lucky in some ways. You know, most of our financial sector is prudentially regulated in some way. it's a very banking, you know, bank-oriented system, and so there just aren't these sort of other kind of entities. Or if they are, it turns out they're part of a banking group and they actually get supervised as a group. And quite a lot of the so-called shadow banks in China also are parts of banking groups, and so it's within the remit of the agencies there, the authorities there, to actually do something about that. And there have been a number of policy policy responses to deal with that, in particular to bring some of that within the supervisory umbrella. But it is definitely a challenge for a lot of countries where you have this sort of big, not prudentially regulated sector. I absolutely agree that that's important.